Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about the state of the estate tax with the estate tax maven, Mark Levine, partner, Handler and Levine, attorneys, LLC. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Bob. How are you?
Everything's good. It's better now. I learn a lot from this, listening to you and your eloquent response, but understandable responses. So there was a major change in the tax law, the tax law, which is like the tent, right? And there's a lot of things underneath that tent. There's personal income tax, corporate income tax, estate tax, and the like. And it was right to the last minute, but there were some changes to the estate law. So why don't we do this? Why don't we talk generally about the estate, but more so initially at the federal. That probably is not going to be a long discussion because it's set so high. But then we'll drill into the state estate tax.
Sure.
So what changes were made at the higher level, if you will?
So in fact, less changes were made than you might think. The big change was that a big change didn't happen. Essentially, what we were all left waiting to see if was the estate tax exemption, the federal exemption, and we'll talk about what goes into that in a minute because I think that's something that's helpful to people, was set at $5,120,000 and as part of the fiscal cliff was scheduled to go down to $1 million. So the exemption level was going to go basically down to about one-fifth of what it was in 2011. And so the big change was that didn't happen. That, in fact, the exemption level stayed essentially the same. It stayed at the over $5 million level, and there were some changes around the edges, but the big change was there wasn't a change. And, you know, so far the only consistent thing in estate taxes has been inconsistency, has been changes. And that's been the way that we've lived with estate tax planning for the last decade. And so now we have what they call permanent estate tax relief, permanent estate tax laws. And of course, what that means is they don't have a plan in place to have it change. That doesn't mean that 2 years from now, a new Congress can't make an entirely different estate tax rule. But what it means is if they do nothing, it stays the way it is and it goes forward the way it's scheduled to go forward. So what is the estate tax exemption? It's set at a $5 million level for 2011. And that's indexed for inflation. And that's a really, really important part of the current estate tax law, because what it means is we don't have a static number. It means that as assets go up, as values go up, as we have inflation, the number doesn't stay the same. And so in 2011, the number was $5 million. In 2012, it was $5,120,000. 2013, it's probably going to be about $5,250,000. And that's going to continue to go up as time goes on.
Okay, now for the listeners, this index to inflation, bring it down to a level that everyone knows. For example, the thrift, the amount that could go into the that can go into the thrift in 2013 is $500 higher than what it was in 2012 because of indexing to inflation. So it impacts people in an everyday situation where I'm not so sure that everybody that's listening now is overly anxious about $5.2 million in the estate. But I don't want to just broad brush that, because at the federal level, that's a significant number. But at the state estate tax, it gets down to a smaller number, still high when people hear it, but when they see what goes into it, and we're going to go into this right later, and I just don't want people tuning off now, saying, that's $5 million, it doesn't apply to me. Well, it may apply to you at the state level, but it's not bad to talk about anyway.
No, and so, you know, real quickly about the federal tax, the what we paid for this, what we gave up, what we lost, was the rate went up. The rate in 2012 was 35%. The rate 20 forward is 40%. So we got some permanence. We got the indexing for inflation. We got uniformity among the different sort of estate taxes, gift tax, generation skipping transfer tax. But it cost us this 40% over 35% number. So the rate's a little higher, but but the actual exemption amount is much higher than it would have been, and it's going to continue to go up as years go on. The other thing that people hear about is they hear, well, it's a $5,250,000 exemption, but for married couples, it's $10 million or $10,500. And the way that works, and the important thing to understand about that is something called portability. Used to be that if your spouse died, they left everything to you. You died. You couldn't go back in time and use their exemption. It was like a coupon. You could use it or lose it. If you didn't use it when you died, if you gave everything to your spouse for free, no estate tax, they couldn't go back in time and use it. Now you can. You can use your spouse's exemption. So, in fact, a married couple could have an effective estate tax exemption of over $10 million if, at the first death, you file an estate tax return if you do some things. So it's really important at the first death now to go and talk to an attorney and make sure, do I have to do anything in order to save my spouse's exemption? And if you do that, you may, in fact, be able to have an exemption that far exceeds the $5 million.
So actually, two, if you will, highly compensated feds, if it's a married situation, or one highly compensated fed that's not married, if something were awful to happen, say, in their 30s, they could grow the assets, or the assets could, now again, it's, grow to even with an inflation-indexed $5 million to the point they would have it. But if there was this marriage situation, then whatever wasn't used by the first to pass could be used together with the other individuals.
Right. So, and it's not that hard to put together that scenario because two feds in their 30s with kids, they have a lot of life insurance. And so suddenly you're going to add $2 million of liquid assets to the family estate. And if that money isn't necessary to be used for the kids, for the spouse, it may grow. And that surviving spouse may live 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and that money may grow significantly. And so while it is something that most of us aren't really concerned about at the first death, it could be something that could be an issue for you down the line. And that's why it's important, even in those younger situations, to go and deal with it and make sure you save that exemption if you can.
To bring back the thrift into focus, it's somewhat the same concept of the thrift. If you continue to invest and let it grow, it can grow to a significant number. Here we're talking about the same thing. It's not the thrift that we're talking about, but it's the summary of all the assets, including the thrift. Isn't the thrift part of somebody's estate when they pass?
Absolutely. So let's real quick just look at, for people who are trying to figure out, look, does this have any meaning to me whatsoever? What goes into your estate for estate tax purposes? And the short answer is everything. Assume that if you have it, if you controlled it, if you determined where it happened to it and where it went, it's probably going to be taxed in your estate. So cash, life insurance, stocks, bonds, your home at the fair market value, the personal property you have, your thrift, your IRA, your 401k, the value of any limited partnerships or businesses, life insurance. And this is the one that people almost uniformly sort of stand up and say, wait a minute, that's not true. I know that's not true because I was told life insurance isn't subject to tax. Life insurance isn't subject to income tax. It is subject to estate tax. So if you have a $1 million policy because you have three kids, that $1 million is subject to the estate tax. It goes into figuring out what you pay. And so that's included personal property, your stuff, and certain lifetime gifts you make over your life. And the other one that really tricks people up is joint property. If you own something joint with rights of survivorship with someone, if it's your spouse, half of it's in your estate, half of it's not. If it's anyone other than your spouse, all of it's in your estate. So if my sister and I own a house joint with rights of survivorship and it's worth $200,000, my death, she gets the house, but my estate is taxed on the full $200,000 unless we can establish that she contributed the equity. So it's really important to understand that joint property doesn't avoid estate taxes.
That's a really good example, too, because there are a number of people of normal means, doing normal things. Maybe they buy a rental property and they own it jointly with somebody else other than the spouse. So this isn't so way out there. And again, somebody's sitting there. They say, well, it's still going to be under $5.2 million. Okay, that's fine. But we're going to the state estate tax in a while. But let's get the feds, because the feds, really, isn't that the defining point? You first start with it and you go, either you are or you aren't. And in many cases, you aren't subject to it, but isn't it the same bedrock for doing the state estate tax?
Yeah, every state almost requires you to first do a federal estate tax return. So, for example, if you're doing an estate tax return in New York, you have to first complete a federal estate tax return with all the federal estate tax rules. You then use that return to complete the New York state estate tax return. So it is the beginning point of everything. That's where you first look at to figure out what's the estate, what are the deductions, what's the net estate, because you don't pay tax on your gross estate, you pay tax on your net estate. What does that mean? Simply, if you have a $400,000 house, they're going to include $400,000 in your estate. But if you have a $375,000 mortgage, you don't really have a $400,000 house, you have a $25,000 house, and that's all they tax you on, is the equity. So that process is the process of the return, and it's that net number that determines if you pay a tax or not.
I remember years ago when the federal estate tax number was not that high. And then when it went high, I thought, nobody's going to have to do these. Now, I'm not an estate person, clearly. And the estate attorney says, oh, no, you have to do this in order to do that. This is the beginning point. And actually, the federal estate tax return is fairly graphic, and it's laid out. I won't say that everybody can follow, but it's got a schedule for a house. It's got a schedule for, like you say, stuff. It's got a schedule for investments and the like. And to look at stuff, you know, people collect stuff over the years, and some of that stuff might go up in value, you know, whether it's coins, whether it's stamps, whether it's, you know, pop art or something like that. And isn't that the appreciated, if you will, stuff? Doesn't that have to be appraised?
Sure. Everything's included. So your coin collection, your stamp collection, your Hummels. We had a client with antique farm equipment collection. All of that has to be valued, and it all has to be included in your estate tax return.
And the valuation has to be in there, too, by the independent third party.
You have to pay somebody to go and figure out what is that collection of Hummels worth, and what is that coin collection worth, and these five lamps are worth $150, but that one lamp is worth $460.
Yeah, I had... it was not that many years ago, and said, well, I'm clearly under that. Why do I have to have this stuff appraised? And I said, because you have to. And then the state is really interested in it. So you do it once, do the feds, and it's carbon copy somewhat for the state. I don't want to say it's a carbon copy. Boy, I date myself. Mirror image. That's even dated, I suppose.
Right. You can't even say Xerox, I think. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, what's that?
the good part is that you do these valuations, and it's good sort of across the board. It's good for the probate court. It's good for the state estate tax. It's good for the federal estate tax. There are very few places where they differ in the valuation need and how you value it. So normally you can do one valuation, and it's going to be good across sort of all three of those platforms.
All righty. Now, as we leave the, we're not leaving the feds, but we wanted to set it out, but we don't want people to stop at the feds and say, I don't have to do it. Now, locally, not that everybody is local, but Maryland is a whole lot less. It's still a high number. What is Maryland?
So the Maryland estate tax exemption, all the rules are the same almost. You look at almost all of the same things to figure out what's in your estate, but the number, the exemption number in Maryland and a number of other states is much lower. So Maryland's $1 million. D.C.'s $1 million. New York's $1 million. Connecticut just lowered theirs, I think, from $3.5 million to $2 million. Different states have different estate tax exemption numbers, and those numbers change.
Did you leave Virginia out for any reason?
Virginia doesn't have a state estate tax at all. So what they had done was they had said basically to the extent that the feds tax you, that's the number we'll tax you at. And then in 2007, they got rid of their state-level estate tax entirely. Now, sometimes that happens, and they come back and put it back in. So Delaware got rid of their estate tax entirely, realized that they needed more money than they had, realized it's easier to tax dead people than live people, and they went back and reinstituted their estate tax. So the estate tax where you live may be different than the federal estate tax. In addition, you are subject to estate tax anywhere you own real estate. So if you live in Virginia, you're thinking, great, no state estate tax at all. We've got a federal estate tax that's 5.25%. I'm not worried about that. But I've got some property in Maryland, or I've got property in New York, or I've got property somewhere else. Those states are still going to look to you to pay an estate tax based on the percentage of your property that's located in that state.
Now, would they have an exclusion for that individual, the Virginia individual that owns property in, say, New York? I'd imagine there's an exclusion in New York, and would we still qualify for that, or do we get a partial exclusion in New York based on the...
The way it works is, what New York says is, we're going to treat you as though you lived in New York to start with. So if you have a total estate that is $2 million, and you've got a $500,000 piece of property in New York, we're going to say, if you were in New York, here's how much tax you would owe. But only 25% of your estate is in New York. So we're going to tax you 25% of what you would have owed if you lived in New York. So that's a little different than how most people envision it. What most people figure is, New York has a $1 million exemption. I only have a $500,000 house in New York. Therefore, I don't have any estate tax in New York. That's not how New York figures it. New York figures it the way that will get them some revenue. So where you live and where you have real estate, you have to look at.
Well, are there any particular states that one would not want to pass in?
You know, I think if you're looking at sort of what are the lowest estate tax exemptions, Ohio had the lowest up until this year when they repealed it. New Jersey now has the lowest. It's 675, I think, unless they change something this year. Rhode Island's is between 800,000 and 900,000. I say between because they've indexed theirs for inflation. They're the only state I'm aware of that has indexed their state-level estate tax exemption for inflation. So theirs goes up every year. Maryland, New York, Connecticut, North Carolina, all of these different states, theirs is a static number. So even though assets values go up, even though inflation, their estate tax number doesn't change.
Wow. And when we talk now about the estate planning in its entirety, there are things that we certainly should look at earlier on in life, mid or maybe even late, to try to get the assets out of the bullseye of estate tax. Now, how do you do that? I've heard trust, and I've heard, we were talking before we went on the air, pet trust and the like, and I've seen them, and that takes it out of the estate?
No. You know, first of all, the goal, as I tell people all the time, is to have an estate tax problem. That's the goal, is to be one of those people who have this as an issue. But simply putting assets into a trust does not avoid estate taxes. So you'll hear a lot of talk about revocable trusts and using revocable trusts to reduce or eliminate estate taxes. And you can. They are a vehicle that you can use. But they're the same vehicle that you do that the same way in a revocable trust as you do in a will, for example. And so you create trusts at the first death so that at the second death, you don't have those assets in the estate. So, you know, again, look at it very simply. I live in Maryland. I have three kids. I've got a lot of life insurance. At my death, I have $2 million of life insurance. And instead of leaving that all to my wife, $1 million of it goes into a trust for the benefit of my wife and my kids. At her death, the money coming out of that trust isn't subject to her estate tax. So we've taken the $2 million, $1 million of it goes to my wife, $1 million of it goes through the trust. And so when my kids get the $2 million, they don't pay any estate tax. That is the most bare bones way of describing how you use a trust to avoid estate taxes. And we're not even really avoiding estate taxes. We're just not wasting my exemption. We're making sure that the estate tax exclusion I had at my death doesn't get wasted. And that's the sort of first step in estate tax planning. So if you live in a state that has one of those lower exemptions, or if you have a lot more money, that's sort of the first thing you look at.
Now, some of the folks listening, Mark, when they hear seven-figure numbers, they go, that's not me. But you're a young guy, young person, all right? A young person with three young children, that $1 million, yes, it's a lot of money, but if, let's say, the primary earner is no longer there, the living expenses are still there. So something large like that doesn't have, you know, we could get into what type of insurance to buy, but I don't think we will. But term insurance is relatively inexpensive, and that's exactly what it is, because if we were unfortunately to go earlier than anticipated, there should be something there to help feed the kids, dress them, educate them, etc. somebody doesn't have children. They might want to leave something behind to a family member that isn't so fortunate, and that might be a way to fund it other than out of their pocket. Is that a fair assumption? Because when people hear, you know, $1 million, they go, I don't need that. And I'm surprised at the clients that come in and they could afford to buy some insurance. Oh, that's plenty. And I go, you got four kids. It's not plenty.
No, that is the driver for a lot of people for estate taxes. In other words, I have a lot of clients, and it's counterintuitive. I have a lot of younger clients in their 20s and 30s with kids who have an estate tax problem in Maryland or D.C., and I have a lot of older clients who don't have an estate tax problem because that life insurance is a huge, huge driver in this. It's not unusual if you have, you know, two or three kids to each parent have $500, $750, $1 million of life insurance. Term insurance is relatively cheap right now. So that is not an unusual occurrence at all. And I know I have a lot of clients who come in and are shocked to learn they have an estate tax issue because they really didn't think that life insurance was included.
And you, and if you had gotten them earlier, you would have guided them into, is there something called a life insurance trust?
There is. There's something called an irrevocable life insurance trust. So, in fact, I lied to you. I said at my death I had a $2 million exemption, $2 million of life insurance in my estate. That's not true. My life insurance is owned in a life insurance trust. What that means is none of it counts for my estate. It's all out of my estate for estate tax purposes. If it had been up to me, if there had been a change I could have made in the estate tax law, I would have taken life insurance out of the calculation for determining the estate tax exemption. Because I think that it's such a big safety net for people, and it really creates estate tax issues for a lot of people where it shouldn't.
Okay, you used two terms. Earlier you said something about a revocable trust, and then I just heard irrevocable. Explain the difference.
Well, a revocable trust is a trust that you can change, amend, upset. You control it.
You can revoke it.
You can revoke it.
Okay.
An irrevocable trust is, shockingly enough, a trust that you cannot revoke. You can't change it. You no longer control it. And that's the key in getting the insurance out of your estate. If you don't own it and you don't control it, then it can, if it's done correctly, be out of your estate for estate tax purposes.
And it's also out of your control, correct?
It's out of your control. All you can do is pay the premium. All you can do is put money in. What happens to it from there is up to the trustee that you've named. It's up to the terms of the trust.
Yeah. I've got a couple where they'll call up and say, is it time? And I go, yeah, it's twice a year. And put some money in, and it's set up. And this was set up for exactly what we were talking about. There are four children. They're not so children anymore, but there are four of them.
You know, it's a lot of people, when we talk about the irrevocable life insurance, they just say, well, I want to put other assets in there. I want other assets to be out of my estate for estate tax purposes. And the thing is, it works really well for term insurance because we don't do anything with term insurance while we're alive. I don't care that I don't control my term insurance. If I put my house in there and I could never control it again or benefit from it, I would care a lot. And so it's really a very specific use type of thing, but it works very well for that.
Okay, and that could be later on in life, if somebody had enough cash, if you will, and assets to carry them through retirement, but maybe even in excess, they could peel some of that off to take it out of the estate and put it into an irrevocable some type of trust. Maybe not the house, though, right?
No.
Although they do have trust for that, don't they?
And they
do. There's some jazzy term.
You know, if you do have an estate tax problem, there's two things that you have to do to deal with it. One is you deal with it from the bottom up. You figure out, how do I pay the tax? The other is you deal with it from the top down. You figure out, how do I make my assets worth less? How do I get rid of my assets? How do I deal with making, you know, my pile worth less or actually making it smaller? And that's what you start doing when you actually have an estate tax issue and you know you're going to pay some taxes.
Okay. Now, we laid this out, you laid this out, and hopefully we've got some people listening that would like to call and ask you a question. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And we're talking with Mark Levine, Handler & Levine, partner, member, principal All those words.
All those things,
I think. Of the law firm Handler and Levine. And I was fortunate enough to meet your partner many, many, many years ago. I think I say this every show.
That seems like too many many's, Bob. You're so young.
I think I was 12 at the time. At least he thought I acted like I was 12. Anyway, he was very instrumental in getting me out of a bind. Not legally, just it was a business, bad business deal. Anyway, so let's come on back and let's talk about some other things people might look like. Certainly they're children, but sometimes children are there and sometimes they're not there, a childless couple. But the substitute for the kids is a pet.
Oh.
And if they were both to go at the same time, who takes care of the pet? And people look at me sometimes when I talk about this, that you're crazy. You're not expecting me to leave money to an animal. How's an animal going to take care of it? Well, the animal doesn't take care of it, but the asset in the trust does take care of it. Is that the way it works?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's really about being responsible and dealing with your obligations. You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is how do you get power to someone? How do you get things to someone? But also, how do you deal with what happens next? And I think pets is one of those things that you have a responsibility to this pet, and you may have a responsibility to the person you're putting in charge of the pet. And pets go, you know, they run the gamut. So they run from fish that, you know, the response my client says is, well, this is the person who's in charge of flushing it down the toilet. And it goes to horses, and it goes to, African gray parrots, and it goes to animals that have long lifespans and are expensive to keep up. And so, you know, being responsible about that in your powers of attorney. If you're not competent, who can make decisions about your pet? How do they deal with it? Can they use your assets for this? Do you want them to? Specifying that they make the pets as available to you as possible, depending on your situation. And then at death, how do we deal with these pets? And the first part of that is who's in charge? Who gets the pet? And sometimes the pet's going to the kids who are also getting the money, so it's really not an issue. Sometimes the pets are going somewhere else. We have clients whose pets are going to friends or family that really can't afford to take care of the pets. And so the question becomes, how do we help them do that? And there are a number of different ways to do it. You can simply say, well, if you take the pet, you get $10,000, and I hope that you'll use that money to take care of my pet. But that is just as enforceable as it sounds, which is to say, not at all. They get the money, and what they do with the pet is up to them. So a lot of people want, they're talking about a bigger sum of money, and they want more control. And that's where you get a pet trust involved, where you put a set aside an amount of money that you think is going to be enough to take care of this pet for its lifespan. And then you set up the rules. And the rules are sometimes just take care of my pet, look out for the money, and at my pet's death, either you get the money or the Humane Society gets the money or someone else gets the money. And sometimes they're really, really involved. Sometimes there are clients who have a lot of concerns about who's taking care of the pet. You know, we have clients who say, well, I want the pet microchipped. Why do we want the pet microchipped? Well, when the pet dies, here's where the money's going. Isn't it easier for the trustee or caretaker just to get a new pet who looks like the old pet? And so we want to make sure we're dealing with the right pet. We have clients who are very specific about the kinds of care, you know, where they're going to live and what kind of food they eat and who their vet is. And so it can be as detailed as you want. It can be as sort of very, very basic as you want. But that's, you really want to think about what happens to my pets and who gets them and can they afford to keep them.
Okay, let's move off of the pets to children. All children aren't created equal. Some have special needs. And I've heard the term special needs trust. And is that the same type of trust, but of the five kids, one really needs care more so than the other four? At least that's, you know, the person's experience. Now, how does that differ then from a child's trust?
Well, a special needs trust is really a very specific kind of thing, because what you're dealing with there is not just a child who has needs, but also a child who would be eligible for some sort of government benefits. If you have a regular trust, so I've created a trust for my three kids, if my wife and I are both gone, there's a trust that takes care of them, and my sister's the trustee, and her job is to use the money for their health and their education and their maintenance and their support and do this and that for them. When you have a child or any beneficiary who may be subject to or may be eligible for government benefits, you usually can't have the trust provide for their primary support. So it's, again, entirely counterintuitive. I'm going to create a trust for my kid, but I'm going to say the trust job is not the primary support of that child because I want the government to come in and provide that primary support. So it becomes sort of a supplemental needs trust. It gives or does things for the beneficiary that the government benefits can't. That's very different from dealing with a child who just has lots of problems, a child that has drugs or alcohol problems or mental issues or things like that, where they should not have access to money for their safety, for other people's safety. But at the same time, they're not going to qualify for government benefits. And so that kind of trust, you're going to be investing much more power and much more discretion into the trustee. And you're going to say to the trustee, you're going to decide when it's appropriate to use this money for this person. And you may decide it's not appropriate at all. And you may require drug testing or, you know, certain indices of sobriety or things like that. And you're really very specific about that.
Could that type of trust have a certain life to it, if you will? Just personal experience. I was named as a trustee and one child was fine. The other one was not bad, but going beyond the visual, there were some issues with employment. And the trust lasted until this child was 40. And at that point, they got whatever was left in it. But what it required me to do is to marshal, it wasn't a huge amount of money, but the money, and have it be there up until the age of 40. And I think we got within about $5 of it. But and fortunately, we got along after a while. And it was just the delta between what they needed for living expenses, which were not extravagant, and what they can actually earn.
I think it's hugely important to plan flexibility and to trust that could last a while. So again, you know, coming back to my own situation, because I spend a lot of time thinking about my own kids and what I want a trust for them to look like if something happens to me. You know, my kids are 7, 10, and 12, and they seem like good kids, but my 7-year-old scares the heck out of me sometimes. And so I have a trust for all my kids that goes till they're 40. And I hope when they're 20, I'm going to look at them and say, that's ridiculous. These are good kids. I'm going to make it 30. And I hope when they're 25, I'm going to look at them and say, I don't need a trust for them at all. These are great kids. But if something happens to me soon, my sister's the trustee, and she has the power to hold the money all the way to 40. She has the power to hold it longer. She has the power to make interim distributions. So if my daughter's a hedge fund manager at 27, my sister can give her everything at 27. She doesn't have to hold it till 40. She's going to be sort of boots on the ground. She's going to understand and know my kids and their lives and what they should have and what they shouldn't, just like hopefully I would have if I was there. So flexibility is really important in these trusts. I always want to be able to give more money sooner if it's appropriate. I always want to be able to have the trustee hold the money longer if there's drugs or alcohol or spousal issues or things like that.
Could you have trust for, say, a non-child, an aunt, an uncle, a dear friend? Can we set up trust for them as well?
Absolutely. Seminar speakers, people on the radio. You can set up trust for anybody. Yeah, absolutely. And it's really, you look at, who do you feel responsible for? Who is it that you want to take care of? And when you give them the money, is it going to help them or hurt them? Or are you worried and not sure? In other words, there are people for whom leaving money is irresponsible. Leaving money outright to a person with a drug problem or an alcohol problem is irresponsible. On the other hand, it may just be a person who makes bad decisions. And you may decide, I want to protect them from their bad decisions, or I don't want to protect them. I'm just going to let them live with it, and I'm going to give them the money anyway. And so whoever it is that you're feeling responsible for that you want to take care of, you're going to craft a trust that makes sense for them, for their needs and circumstances and their relationship with the trustee and things like that.
Now, in dealing with this, you a whole lot more so than I, when somebody appoints a trustee and the trustee, you know, they don't know. They say, yeah, I want to be a good person. I'll be the trustee. Do the trustees ever come to you and say, Mark, how did I get into this and how do I get out?
Absolutely. I mean, there are trustees that have been named. They're farther down the line. You know, we always encourage clients to name backups, and sometimes those backups aren't as interested in doing it as you would hope they would. And so, again, the trust should have built into it a facility to name successors, to resign, to turn it over to someone who has a greater interest in doing it or a greater ability in doing it. So again, a good trust should be set up so that a trustee can leave if they want to leave, as long as they give notice and, you know, turn over all the assets and things like that.
Let's say that the person either didn't want to or shortly after they decided that they would, they don't want to be, but there's no successor trustee mentioned anywhere. Can they just, I won't say walk away, but is there some legal mechanism to say, I want to do the right thing, but I can't do this? Where do they go? Do they go back to the attorney that was settling the estate? Do they go to court to have somebody named?
If there's no language in the trust, you might end up having to go to court. And the best thing to do in those situations is arrange it all ahead of time. In other words, say, look, I either don't have the ability or the interest in doing this or both. We've located a person who's acceptable to everybody, get everyone's consent. And, you know, present that to the court. And the court is happy to have things with bows tied on them and have a sort of everything set up to be done. And so you can do it. And we do that on occasion.
All right. Let me ask you this. In dealing with your clients, do you suggest that you ask a client, who would you like to be the trustee? And it's da-da-da-da. And who would you like to be the successor? And da-da-da-da. Now, do you suggest to your clients that the client, then tell the first trustee that they've been named as the trustee sooner or later?
It just depends on the people. Relationships, I mean, what makes our job so interesting is people and relationships vary infinitely. And so who the people are and their relationship to the person, and I think it's always better to tell them if the relationship is strong enough. If you're sure that 2 years from now, you're not going to have to say to them, you're not the trustee anymore. Someone else is. And that's, I think, the big inhibitor for people telling people is that they're afraid that, 2 years from now, I'm going to pick someone else. And I don't want to have to go back to my brother and say, look, I'm not using you anymore. I'm using my brother-in-law to do that or something like that. And so I think that plays into it some. There are certain things you always tell people, healthcare directives. They don't do any good if the people don't know that they're not named. But everything else, if you really don't want to tell someone, it's enough to say, look, if something happens to me, call my lawyer. He knows where all the paperwork is. He or she can tell you what to do next, et cetera. But I think it's always better if you're comfortable with the person to tell them.
Okay. Now, I really wasn't asking that question for the next question, but it just popped out. We have cars now. Cars don't need tune-ups as often as they used to. So I write my will. I set all this stuff up, and I'm happy, and I'm smiling. And a year or two later, exactly what you just said. I named XYZ to be the trustee, and they've really exhibited some silly behavior. When do I go back after I do my first creation of the wills and the trust with you and come in for a tune-up?
So we suggest clients come in every 3 to 4 years. We try and send letters out to clients every, 3 or 4 years to say, come back in for a checkup. Our clients almost uniformly ignore that letter. then we send another letter out a couple years later. And hopefully in that 5-6 year period, people come in. Births, deaths, divorce, inheritance, marriage, if you win the lottery, those are all reasons to give us a call and come back in, or give your lawyer a call and go back in and say, here's what's changed. Big changes your lawyer should be telling you about in the law and the estate taxes, things like that. But there's always little changes. There's always little things that may affect you or may make something easier for you. And so coming in for that checkup makes sense.
Okay. Now, I was leading up to this. I need a checkup. How do I get in touch with you?
Oh, okay. you can call us. The phone number is 301-961-6464. And my extension is 3313. So that's 301-961-6464, extension 3313. Probably easiest is email me, Mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com, HANDLERLEVINE.com. So that's Mark at handlerlevine.com. We do work with and meet with clients in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. And happy to take email questions or if you want to give us a call, happy to talk to you.
And you have offices in Virginia as well as Maryland, correct?
We have offices that we meet with people in Tysons and in Alexandria, yeah.
Okay.
Bring it sort of back around, because there was another part of the estate tax change in terms of gift taxes. And one of the questions that we get a lot with when we start talking about estate and gift taxes is people are very confused about what gift taxes are. And the fact is that very, very few people are ever going to pay a gift tax. It's kind of a misnomer. If you give more than your lifetime exemption in your life, you have to pay a gift tax. But that lifetime exemption is the same as the federal estate tax exemption. So that means that you'd have to be someone who's decided you A, have $5,250,000 and B, want to give that away before you even have to start thinking about an estate tax or a gift tax that would be payable. The other thing is the annual exclusion gift, the $14,000. So last year it was $13,000. This year it's up to $14,000. When you give that to someone, if you stay below that for the entire year, you don't have to even file a gift tax return. You don't have to tell IRS that you made the change. And it's not income to the person who receives it. And I think this is one of the big misunderstandings that people have. If you give your child $10,000, $14,000, $100,000, it's not subject to income tax for them. They don't pay any tax on any amount of money that you gift to them. You may have to file a gift tax return and tell IRS that you gave it, but if it's under the 5 1/4 for your lifetime, the $5,250,000, you don't have to pay an estate tax, a gift tax.
But the IRS's computer in the sky is tracking this so that when you do pass and they say this person passed and they had 5 1/4 minus these gifts that were in excess of the exclusion, so they're totally...
They're keeping track. In other words, you're required to tell IRS. If you give your son $40,000 for a down payment, you're required to tell IRS, gave my son 40, 14 of it's free. The other 26, IRS is going to keep track of for the rest of your life. But honestly, if you have a $2 million of total assets, you could give all of that away, and it's not an issue from a federal estate tax point of view.
All right. Now, a gift should not be looked at as a gift to a charity. So in other words, if I wanted to give, and this is a lot of money, if I wanted to give $15,000 to a charity and I wanted to give $15,000 to a favorite person, I'd have to file the gift tax return for the favorite person, but not the charity. Is that the way it works?
That's right. The charity, you're going to get the deduction on your income tax return. The person, you're going to have to file with IRS and tell them you gave the $15,000.
I think that's in my world, that's where the rubber does not meet the road. Why are they so interested in this? And I said, well, and then they'll go, oh, okay. But again, it's an awful lot of money that someone would exceed anyway. But sometimes as people's needs decrease, but their income is constant, they do have some excess funds and they'd like to give it to the kids and the like. And they're not totally aware of this gift tax thing. And they think that if they do exceed it and they have to file it somehow, that's going to be an awful thing. And it's just, it's uncle keeping track for us. Just in case we weren't.
Absolutely. And sometimes you're better off not making the gift, you know, because of what are called the carryover basis rules, when you give an appreciated asset, the person takes it at your basis. So, you know, someone came up to me after a seminar and said, mom and dad were terrified of estate taxes, of death taxes and probate. And so while she was an only child, she said, while they were alive, they gave me their house. Now I'm going to sell it for next week for $400,000. They just died. What am I going to pay in taxes? Well, mom and dad bought the house for $50,000. It's worth $400,000 now. She's going to pay capital gains on $350,000 of gain because she's using their basis that they bought it for. If she had inherited that house, all the capital gains goes away. It's gone. And so she gets to act like she bought it for $400,000, sells it for $400,000, pays no capital gains tax at all.
That would also be true of, say, a stock or a mutual fund. Mm-hmm. But let's say it's... let's call it an heirloom. My mother got it from her mother, and it was a little metal dog. And now it's an antique, and it's worth a bunch of money. I'm not saying millions. I mean, it might be worth $2,000 or $3,000. Mm-hmm. And if I sell it, and because it was given to me, I have to figure out what mom paid for it, which was probably about $10. And the people listening are saying, who's ever going to know that? We're giving you the what you're supposed to do.
No, and that's the what you're supposed to do. But where people get tripped up is real estate and stocks and bonds. I mean, real estate, I hear probably every other class, someone comes up and says, mom gave me her house. because she thought it would be easier, because she thought it would avoid probate, because she thought it would avoid estate taxes. And it turns out that the only one of those, or, you know, the first two are true and the last one's not. It's going to avoid estate taxes, but now you've got this capital gains problem.
Ouch.
Yeah. And that's it's a really common thing for people throughout the country. And this happens a lot. People, mom and dad, have a house where they grew up in Nebraska and they gave it to the kids.
And this is especially sensitive with your comment regarding the house worth, whether it's 200, 300, or 400. Under the new tax laws, that changes the entire ball game of the return.
That's right.
It increases the taxes on the gain itself and others. This is no political comment. It's real. And when people first look at the higher tax rates, they're very high. But if there was a windfall in any particular year, it just floats the boat for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And just a comment. Now, Mark, you brought it up, and I was going to try to close out with it. What if you were, I don't want to say the top five, but give me frequent questions you get from class that you really save the day for the person.
I've probably given you two, which is the life insurance and the house. I mean, the house is one that comes up a lot. Mom's thinking about giving us the house. Mom gave us the house. Mom wants to give us a house. We want mom to give us a house. How do we deal with that? And I think that is probably, from a dollars and cents point of view, one of the biggest things. Because if you've got a state estate tax that's 16% and you're going to be subject to a 20% capital gains tax, it suddenly makes more sense to inherit the property than it does to be given the property. So I think that's one of the biggest things that people don't understand. Other things that come up about healthcare directives, the differences between do not resuscitate orders and healthcare directives. A do not resuscitate order isn't a healthcare directive and vice versa. And so a lot of people don't understand the relationship between those two things. I think the idea with trusts about the making sure that your beneficiary designations are tied into the trust. So if you're creating a trust for your spouse or your children or your grandchildren, how do you make sure the money flows in there? Because the beneficiary designations will override your will. So if my will says put my life insurance in the trust, but my life insurance designation says give it to Bob, Bob gets it. And it doesn't matter that that doesn't make any sense or not. The beneficiary designation controls what's going to happen in that situation. And I think one of the other big things that we talk about is the impact of retirement funds on estate planning. Because with retirement funds, you know, we talked about the fact that the TSP is included in the estate tax calculation, but they don't take out the income tax that you're ultimately going to pay on that money when you take it out when they are determining what it's worth. So you might say a house is worth $400, but there's a $375 mortgage. Oh, they're only going to tax me on $25. TSP, it doesn't work that way. TSP, if it's worth $300, they're not going to back out the income taxes that are owed down the line by whoever gets it, whether it's the next year or the next 10 years or the next 50 years. And so it's going to be subject to the full estate tax.
Okay, let me pretend I just listened to you for your talk in class, and I go, Mark, can I give the stock away now so that I'll sell the stock now and I'll pay the taxes on it, then I'll give them the cash. Do you get those kind of questions?
Yeah. In other words, a lot of people trying to figure out what's the easiest, most efficient, cheapest way to get the assets from me to my kids. And so is it easier to pay it now and pay the tax and those things? And again, it depends on the capital gains. So if you bought Exxon at $1, then it really might not make sense to sell it now and you pay the capital gains and then give it to your kids as cash. On the other hand, if you bought it at 89 and it's 90, it may make more sense to do it. And so what the assets are and what your goals are. Other times I have clients whose goal is, look, I've got three kids. Two of them are I'm not concerned about at all, but one of them needs a place to live. And I want to give them the house so that at my death, the other two aren't arguing, oh, he got the house and we didn't, or they're not litigating. I want to make sure he's got a place to live. And so, you know, we talk about the fact that making distributions are not just about taxes. They're not just about what you're going to pay. They're about what you're trying to accomplish.
And as well, the thrift, traditional IRAs, notice I didn't say Roth in either case, they're tax batter kegs, right? So that, you know, I'm going to take my money out of the thrift. I'm going to take my money out of the IRA and then give it to my kid so that they don't have to pay taxes on it. I had a professor in school a long time ago, and I'll just never forget it. He said, hey, deferred tax is the best type of tax. So the longer one can defer it, and even if one passes and they left, you know, one of these tax powder kegs, they don't have to take it out all at once. They can spread it out over a pretty long period of time.
No, absolutely. And we spend a fair amount of time talking about, you know, how do we do that? And the problem is, while they don't have to take it all out at once, while they can defer it, a 25-year-old can defer it over the next 50 years of their life, they don't have to. They can take it all out. And then the worst happens. They take out $250,000. They don't consider the fact that half of that's going to be owed in income taxes because they're shooting their income way up and their income tax rate with it. And then they buy whatever it is they're going to buy or go wherever they're going to go or invest in whatever they're going to invest in. And a year later, the tax is owed and they don't have the money. And that's the real powder keg for a lot of inherited IRAs.
Okay, now we're coming down to the last couple, right, Andrew? All righty. And one more time, how do we get in touch with you? Because we've done a lot of different things that kind of cover the waterfront as far as people's, oh, I didn't know that. What's the contact point again?
The phone number is 301-961-6464, and my extension is 3313. The email is mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com, handlerlevine.com.
Okay, now certainly they should call you, but there are some people out of town listening to this. Within a minute, what's the best advice? I don't want to go. I don't want to do a will because that means I'm going to have to face the fact that I'm going to pass, and maybe I'm married, maybe I'm not. But you know, the other people are anxious about this. It's like I don't want to go to the dentist. The tooth doesn't hurt that much. So when should somebody just say, "No, I got to do it"?
Well, it's not going to shock anyone to learn. I think the earlier the better. I mean, you have kids, you're going to have to do it, and that's the bottom line. Just like you have to have life insurance, you have to figure out where they're going to school. You have to sit down and do your will and figure out who's going to take care of them. So you can answer the question, if something happens to me, you're taken care of.
Okay. This has been a great legal discussion as well as psychology. You have a great tone as well. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for being here. We'll be here next week. I'm not so certain what we're doing. I wish I could remember what I'm doing next week, but I believe it might be a tax show of all things. Anyway,
that does sound like fun.
Have a good week, and thanks for coming, Mark. Andrew, thanks for taking good care of us. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.